Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Look Ahead podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Later in the program, the winners of the Space and Defense Innovation Competition at South by Southwest from sunny Austin, Texas. But first, joining us now is my good friend Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners for a look at the week ahead and discuss whatever else is on his mind. Byron, thanks very much for joining us. Wouldn't be Monday without you. Hope you guys had a great weekend.
We did it. Happy Budget Day, Vago.
Happy Budget Day to you, Byron. This is a ritual that you and I have now had for more than 30 years. So I'm honored to be talking to you on the day the Biden administration submitted its FY 2025 budget request to the United States Congress. But first, a quick word from our sponsor. HII is the designer and operator of the U.S. Navy's live virtual constructive training enterprise, the largest LVC enterprise in the U.S. Department of Defense. HII delivering the advantage. Byron, walk us through. Our mutual friend Tony Capasio of Bloomberg has an unbroken four-decade-long record of getting the budget numbers in advance of the budget coming out. So kudos to one of the best reporters to have graced this beat. Numbers match his $849.8 billion for the top line, $167.5 for procurement, $143.2 for research, development, testing, and evaluation, all of which is down from 2024, but $800 million higher than we had expected. Walk us through these numbers and what you think they mean.
Look, you know, the top line had been known, the defense top line had been known because of the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2024. And at least what Tony gave us was the procurement and RDT&E numbers. You know, they were kind of more or less in line with my expectations. I think, you know, you kind of knew all along when the DOD got the $10 billion top line cut, or I shouldn't say DOD, when defense got the $10 billion top line cut, because that affected not just the Department of Defense, but some of the nuclear activities in the Department of Energy and other parts of other agencies that contribute to national security. You know, that cut was going to have to go somewhere. And it was just unlikely that DOD had a lot of room to cut military personnel. The whole focus on readiness that we've heard loud and clear, particularly from the Air Force, made it to me that it was unlikely that O&M or operations and maintenance could be cut. So, you know, the most probable place was going to be it would fall on the investment accounts. You know, we'll get all the details, not just later Monday, March 11th, but, you know, as the justification books come out. And, you know, there's a lot of data to sort through. Let's really see where some of these cuts have been made. Some had already been reported and telegraphed that I think are just, you know, I don't really worry about them because I think Congress will restore them. I mean, I absolutely think that if all the media reports are true and there's only one Virginia-class submarine, Congress will restore that funding. But F-22s may be another matter. I don't, we can get to it in a couple of minutes, but I think the changes that the Army made to its aviation plans, those are probably going to stand pat. But, you know, the devil's going to be in the detail, and there are always going to be little things and nuances to look for in this budget drop. It's hard to say, you know, what the comparison is to FY24, because we only have the request. We don't know what Congress is going to do with the FY24 numbers. The bill text on the six-bill omnibus should be out hopefully this week, if not maybe next week, if they're going to meet the March 22nd deadline. You know, you guys talked a little bit about on Friday. You know, I raise my odds that FY24 gets done. That's probably a little late to do, but, you know, I thought it was good news that Congress passed the six-bill appropriations omnibus on the margin that it did. And I think, you know, as much as there may still be some issues or events that could potentially trip up the timing of this, the next tranche, I think it'll still get done and probably get done. If it doesn't get done before the Easter recess, I think it will get done in April, and we'll see something close to the administration request. The big question then is, so what happens to the supplemental? And, you know, because you really have to, you can't look at this as just base and supplemental. I mean, the industry is going to feed from the same funding flows. So, FY25 could be down significantly from FY24, but that depends on what the appropriations are for the supplemental. If not, I think on just base budget to base budget, it's down slightly from the FY25 to FY24, but the FY24 has a big asterisk by it.
I think those who oppose Ukraine aid, in, whether it's through affinity for Vladimir Putin or to try to hurt Ukraine, don't understand that they're actually hurting America's ability to rearm itself fundamentally, because so much of that money for rearmament is sitting in the supplemental, which we heard from the Army Undersecretary Gabe Camarillo, who joined us last week for the program, and it was a terrific discussion where he sort of laid that out, and, in terms of the importance, or I should say 2 weeks ago he joined us in order to be able to make that case. In your note, and it doesn't look like that's moving, right? I mean, despite the president's impassioned plea in the State of the Union, right, that needle is not moving, as we heard from Michael, and it may not move until August.
And there could be other proposals. One I've heard is an idea that, well, instead of appropriating this money for Ukraine, make it a loan. Although, then again, you're back to, so what's Ukraine's fiscal capacity to pay this back? Was there some kind of lend-lease agreement, or there are other potentially creative ways to do this, but at the end of the day, you're still talking about equipment and services that someone has to pay for. And if Ukraine is already running a pretty horrific budget deficit, so that I suppose is an option, but their ability to repay that, the US may ultimately be footing that bill in any event.
And Dov Zakheim has made the case, and we do have a lend-lease program, but the fundamental question is putting that massive investment in for the weapons recapitalization. In your note today, you made the case for alternative defense futures to ponder. What are those alternative defense futures?
Well, you've actually highlighted at least one of these that I called out on your show, Vago. It was really riffing off of kind of two or three events that have been going on. The instability in Haiti, which Secretary Blinken is going to be in Jamaica this week. I think trying to figure out how not just the United States, but maybe a group of like-minded nations in the Caribbean, Latin America, even Africa could help restore what's really kind of a state of nature in Haiti. That's a country of 11.5 million people. Mass refugee movement, genocide. All sorts of bad things could come out of a situation that really looks pretty horrific right now. The other was just this has been going on for a couple of months, but the changes that appear to be coming out of North Korea, some really very provocative steps that Kim has taken. I think the kind of consensus, at least is reflected in what most of the media and think tanks have been focused on, has been it's all about China, it's all about Russia, Ukraine, and it's about the Middle East. But a war on the peninsula in Korea could have as devastating economic impact, I suppose, as a war in Taiwan. It's inevitably going to involve the US and probably Japan, and obviously do some pretty horrific damage to the global economy, let alone be a humanitarian catastrophe as well too. So, these things I think are worth keeping top of mind. But the two other things that I called out were it was a RAND Corporation report on kind of a neo-medieval world, and I think you had a podcast on this back in mid-January with the authors of that report and Barry Pavel at RAND Corporation, which really kind of, instead of great, it was a different take on great power competition, that this would be a contest, but not necessarily with major conventional military forces. It would be a more chaotic world. You and I, we've used the term entropy, kind of this subtle decay. Maybe Haiti is a good example of that. Maybe what's going on in the Middle East is another example of that. So that was one thing to kind of riff off, that there would just be these continued demands on militaries, not just in the United States, but also on China, not necessarily to prepare for high-end conventional war, but to get involved in these messy, operations to restore stability to parts of the world. And the contest is necessarily maybe more political than it is just straight military technology. The other was a paper that was released by the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation of Andy Marshall fame and the Office of Assessment. But that paper really looked at scenarios. It was a series of essays about what would cause the U.S. to not become a great power. That basically it was just another global state by 2053. I thought it was interesting because the essays were fairly provocative. A couple of them riffed off this theme of, it's literally a medical breakthrough that allows people to live much longer, and then that creates all sorts of fiscal pressures, just given the costs of supporting an older population, medical, all that other good stuff. But how that could really compel the U.S. to look inward. There were other scenarios involving things like Mexico, which, not this year, not next year, but or maybe it could be next year if you had a Republican administration really started, bombing fentanyl sites or going after cartels in Mexico. I mean, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see how that would be a very substantial change in our security posture. And, as we've seen with the Houthis and Hamas in the Middle East, entities that are able to build submersibles or use drones on one another, I'm talking about drug cartels in Latin America. You can imagine what happens if those things start landing in Tucson or Miami or Dallas, which is not inconceivable. So I just think it's always good to keep an open mind here. There's a book I have on my bookcase here by Rita McGrath at Columbia University, who talks about looking for change and inflection points. I just have to keep looking. I don't think any of these are high probability right now. Certainly global political system, economic system is not behaving as if there's a war that's imminent in North Korea, but keep an eye on it. And then these other factors, Mexico, Haiti, really just a different way of competing. They all can bear on the defense sector in maybe different and subtle ways that strategists and planners ought to be thinking through.
Thanks very much for citing that discussion. It was a pleasure talking to Barry and Dr. Tim Heath on that neo-medieval report. President delivered an energetic State of the Union address, but it's unclear what changed domestically or internationally. We talked about Ukraine aid. That doesn't appear to be moving any more quickly, even with the Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson in the audience. And today, the Swedish flag was raised as officially the 32nd member of the Atlantic Alliance. The president made his case for higher taxes on the ultra wealthy, as well as increasing taxes on corporations from 21 to 28%, making a case for fairness. That said, he's wanted more money for the IRS and a whole bunch of other things that he hasn't gotten. And in fact, in this funding measure to avert a government shutdown, we saw, cuts to the FBI budget, cuts to the Justice Department budget, and cuts to the EPA, which is stuff that Democrats would not normally have embraced, but they're doing so in order to be able to get government funded. Right. Walk us through what sort of broader impact any of this State of the Union rhetoric has on the industrial base, or policy, strategy, spending, you name it.
Well, look, Vago, I think, Pew Research had a pretty interesting little missive out last week that I think this is absolutely one of the earliest times we've effectively seen the two presidential candidates more or less decided in a U.S. election. We don't know who the ultimate winner is going to be, but I kind of gave people a little homework assignment, which is, go back and look at these State of the Union addresses or messages, because it was really the State of the Union addresses, kind of FDR's characterization of this. There is a requirement, I guess, in the Constitution for the president to deliver a message to Congress that goes back to 1790, but it's early on in the presidential campaign. I don't know what could happen, between now and election day. I mean, the maybe consensus that, the president was a doddering old man, he certainly, to me, disproved that in the State of the Union. I did see something that was kind of intriguing. I think as far as viewership was concerned, it was a highly watched State of the Union address, but a lot of people were Fox News viewers. So maybe they were hoping for something, cataclysmic in terms of the president's ability to deliver the address. That certainly didn't happen. And I think the tone of his address was also, this was a campaign speech, not necessarily here's my agenda for FY25, what he hopes to get done in the budget and this year in Congress. I thought James Fallows had an interesting piece out that, because he'd written some of these addresses in his career, but it was a pretty interesting dissection that, and I thought one of the components that stood out was, this wasn't kind of a, hey, let's bring the country together, and we're all going to work together for some common good. This was kind of a, there's my predecessor and his views and his, kind of policies. And this is what I want to do, and this is what I think it's best for the country. So it was a different tone.
Right.
I kind of put it more in the campaign bucket than, help me pass my legislation. I think realistically, he recognizes there's not a whole lot that Congress is going to do in an election year to push his ideas and thoughts ahead.
I love the fact that for once you gave the audience a homework assignment to go all the way back to 1790 to today to form that up. And it wasn't always an address to Congress, right? All the chief executive has to do is to report to Congress the State of the Union. GE Aerospace hosted an investor day last week, and we're getting short on time. Walk us through takeaways from that, as well as the Army Aviation hearing last week, right? I mean, a lot of folks were left scratching their heads in the Future Armed Reconnaissance Aircraft cancellation, one of the two pillars of future vertical lift on which the Army has spent many billions of dollars. That folks, when that program was launched, would have told you unmanned systems are likely a better way of executing that, which is what some friends in the reconnaissance army aviation field were saying, and especially that close, right? I wonder if this had already been down selected if the ITEP engine was available sooner. Anyway, walk us through both of those real
Well,
quick
look,
before we get to
let me
the week.
do chronologically because I think the hearing I thought was interesting about that was, I think the Army did a good job about defending the reasons why it made the changes in Army aviation that it did. I think the idea that they put forward was there was a lot that they could salvage from the FARA program, including the ITEP engine, but also some of the architecture and the sensors that have been developed for that. So, they'll put that money back into Black Hawk and probably Apache. And kind of the GE Aerospace event, it was primarily as one would expect about commercial aerospace, since that's really the bulk of what GE Aerospace does. But from a defense standpoint, I thought the message that I heard was, we have a pretty diverse portfolio. I could look out, 3, 4, 5 years, and they have some potential challenges in their portfolio as things like the F-15EX, the P-8, potentially in production. F-18 will be out of production. They're still going to have a large installed base of service revenue, but some of the technology investments they've made, the ITEP engine is one, the adaptive engine for the F-35, but that could find a home in the F/A-XX or NGAD programs.
Right.
I think they have a pretty diverse portfolio, and that theme of innovation and portfolio diversity. The growth numbers that they provided for their defense business, I think, are reasonable. They did not talk about a low-cost engine for the Collaborative Combat Aircraft program, which was discussed at the Air Force Association Warfare Symposium. But I think that's another kind of very intriguing strategic development for that company and their portfolio.
Real quick, a look at the week ahead. What should the audience be paying attention to this week?
Well, there are a series of hearings in House Armed Services, kind of on different nuances, hypersonics, software, but not the traditional oversight hearings we see when a FY24, when any new budget is dropped. I suppose those are going to happen after Easter, maybe next week. There are two events, one at Bruegel, one at Brookings, that deal with European defense. I think these are important themes, particularly given the EU's announcement last week of a 1.5 billion euro investment in the European defense industrial base. I think that, again, that kind of posturing got underscored based on Trump's comments after meeting Viktor Orban from Hungary, where he said basically he'd cut off all aid to Ukraine if he was elected. So, these are the kind of things that I think are really going to get Europe focused on its defense spending. They still have their fiscal challenges. There's still more awareness, but they're going to have to hedge more for potential changes in the United States.
Byron, thanks so very much for joining us. It's always a pleasure. Hope you have a great week and look forward to having you back on again next week.
Thank you, Vago.
An absolute pleasure. And a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, and American Rheinmetall. And joining us now is Tim Chrisman, partner in the space practice at the Distinctive Edge Partners PR firm, who's joining us from the sidelines of South by Southwest, that has become a key innovation gathering in its own right, down in sunny Austin, Texas. Joy Schauffler, the firm's founder and principal, joined us a couple of weeks ago to discuss the competitors across five categories that are vying for the annual Space and Defense Showcase. Tim is here to talk about the winners across five categories that are open to everybody from primes to startups across space, cyber, AI, renewable energy, and broader tech. Tim, great to have you on the program, and it's about damn time.
It's great to be here, Vago. Great to be here.
An absolute pleasure. I'm sorry that I couldn't be down there with you guys for the action this year, because South by Southwest really has turned into a terrific venue where you have some of the most interesting conversations of the year. But first, walk us through the winners this year and why the judges picked them.
Yeah, absolutely. We had five categories. We had space, we had integrated sensing and cyber, AI and autonomy, renewable energy and storage, and then a wild card. To start off with, in reverse order there, with renewable energy and storage, we had the company Mesadyne won that category. They have a new way of generating power. They've got a generator that it's a little bit bigger than a Nalgene bottle that can generate power from just about anything. It burns it. So it's like a standard portable generator that burns fuel, but this will burn garbage. This will burn hydrogen. You name it, it'll burn it. Super quiet. At the end of the day, they had a working prototype on stage with them that was on the whole time they were presenting. And you could barely hear it. It sounded like a fan on a laptop. The technology was cool, but I think at the end of the day, when the judges realized that this prototype was on and it had the potential for military operators to be able to use anywhere in the world with little to no heat or audio signature, that was a clear and easy win for them. In the space category, Outpost took the prize there. Outpost is a company making satellites that can return from space. Since the 60s, people have been launching stuff into space, but almost nothing has come back other than people. Very little. And they had some pretty impressive stats that it ended up being like half or less than half of a percent of all the mass that has gone into space actually comes back. And that really limits the potential of space, especially as companies are trying to manufacture pharmaceuticals and advanced components in zero gravity. They need to be able to come back. There's also the potential of like positioning equipment in space for humanitarian and military uses. And so it seemed like it was a very clear value proposition for the judges that, a organization that has some verified technology that could be of use to the Department of Defense for rapid response and humanitarian efforts was right. going to be a clear winner there. Let's see, going on to AI and autonomy. The winner there was SimWorks. This is a startup that it was looking to streamline the way that medics are able to access and transmit data about their patients. Mm-hmm. The founder, John Chapman, as a former recon Marine, and talked extensively about how, you know, historically, patients are in combat situations. The idea was you need to evacuate these people within 60 minutes or they were going to die. And right. how advances in medical technologies gotten to the point where medics can now keep people alive for up to 3 days. The problem is they don't have an easy way to pass off the data to be able to get data from rear echelon hospitals in terms of like their questions answered and then passing the notes back and forth. And so, you know, these field medics are basically becoming field surgeons. And so they need to be able to pass a lot of data back and forth. And they developed a tool that looked like the armband a NFL football player has or a quarterback has on that has all the patient data on it. It's got the ability to send and receive info about the patient, and that gets passed up the chain. So that way there's sort of seamless continuity of care. It was a compelling case. He had the technology, a prototype on while he was presenting. And so it was another case of, you know, being able to show the judges this technology in action was one of those reasons why it sold there. So then in the wild card category, we had Productible. So this is a company that founded by a handful of people out of Google and some of the other large tech companies that looks to help. Initially, they started with the commercial sector to help drive portfolio analysis and investors with more data, helping them make more data-driven allocation decisions. But they realized very quickly that this is something that could be useful in the department when there's a huge amount of data available, but it's not synced up. And so they've been pivoting to try to help connect stakeholders and data across silos. So that way there can be a true portfolio look and allocate resources a little more efficiently. They, you know, this is a team that, as I said, is like former Googlers, some Disney people, very compelling, very exciting case that they made. You know, if anything right now that can help the Department of Defense be more data driven, I think is a clear winner there.
Absolutely fascinating assortment of companies. And, you know, folks who don't know your bio, you're also the executive director of the Foundation for the Future and are a former U.S. Army intelligence officer, special operator, as well as had some time in the CIA. So I could see how all of these technologies would appeal to you as a judge in this endeavor. Walk us through what the timelines are going to be for companies that want to participate in next year's event, because I know that it's in the latter part of the year that you guys open up the application process. Tim, walk us through what are sort of the key dates that folks out there in the audience who are interested in this should be submitting their paperwork.
Yeah, no. For, you know, companies that are interested in participating next year, you know, by all means, reach out now. You can find out more at sdireception.com. Reach out now and let us know you're interested. We'll, you know, any applications are going to be opening late fall and for early December close. So if you're interested, might as well reach out now at sdireception.com.
Indeed. And we should say that we're partnered on the space and defense innovation of, effort down there as well. And one last question. You've been part of this since almost its inception, the defense part of South by Southwest. How has this arts festival actually turned into such a key innovation, innovation event each year?
I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the organizers of South by Southwest have followed where innovation is happening. And we've seen over the past few years the Defense Department getting more serious about innovating and truly trying to get outside of its historic bubble. And South by Southwest has taken notice and started to pick up more and more programming around defense, around space, and it's been exciting.
Tim, pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so very much for joining us, especially on such short notice. And look forward to having you on again in any one of a number of your capacities. We've never had a boring conversation and look forward to having you on regularly.
Thank you, Vago. Take care.
Thanks again.